there is no rushing when it comes to planting orchids, so we have to be nice and calm and relaxed. It's a beautiful thing that we're doing today, long time coming. We've got hopefully 100 xanthochylas going back into the ground today, which is very exciting considering we've only got 3. We're going to leave all the vehicles here and we're going to walk into the site where we're planting, except for me. I'm going to take my vehicle because it's got all of the equipment that we need in the back of it. I've got papers in there.
Three tiny, hairy, thin little leaves push themselves up into the morning air. These three leaves are on the only 3 remaining yellow-lipped spider orchids in the whole Loddon Mallee region in Victoria. Their numbers will swell to 103 by the end of the day. We're planting 100 orchids today on Off Track. My name's Anne Jones and this is RN, and I'm at Kayura State Park in central Victoria, which is on Jaja Warung land.
Okay, well first I want to say thank you everybody for coming along. We do have quite a few people.
Julie Whitfield is from Amaryllis Environmental and she's administering this orchid reintroduction program on behalf of the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning in Victoria. And today's focus is just one species, a tiny plant which may flower once a year if the conditions are just right. And when it does, a tiny stalk appears. And then, sitting on top of that, will be a pale yellow, almost green, orchid flower. The flower looks like a skinny starfish, but with a mouth in the middle with the tongue hanging out. Marvellously salacious things happen inside this flower, but more on that later. We carry an immense amount of gear in for this orchid planting, potting tables, protective cages, water, and of course the pots which are full of the tiny little orchids. This is prime habitat and there's a small herbivore-proof enclosure that's been built. We approach it and we dump all of this stuff. It's not a matter of just grabbing a pot and planting them willy-nilly. These are going to be intimately tracked over time, so the whole planting process is extremely rigid. I would say that it's almost like a military operation, but just one that's got a lot more kebab sticks than you'd expect. Julie Whitfield.
Each plant gets planted out into one of these little plots, and each planting spot will actually be staked out for you with a kebab stick. So you will know exactly where that plant is to go because each plant fits within a grid. And then we even measure from our A peg and our B peg so that we can get an accurate measurement of exactly where that plant is situated within that quadrat. So every year we can come back and we can see if that same plant has emerged or not. So each plant is actually allocated a little disc. So each plant is given a number and then we will track the history of that plant through that number and its measurement. And then one plant comes out at a time. Only one comes out at a time. Its leaf length is measured, its width is measured, and then a bit of the soil is cleared off and the tuber width is measured as well.
5, 6, 7. The plants are tiny, much smaller than I expected. There are multiple pots and each of them has multiple plants and they all have to be measured and tagged before being planted into quadrats, which are freshly marked in the enclosure. This is going to take a while.
I'm going to just dig down in here. Now this is a delicate operation. I don't want to hurt the plant for its tuber. Now this one's down really deep, so I'm going to twist this pot a little and squeeze down the bottom there.
Julie Whitfield spoke with me while she was measuring the tiny orchid tubers with calipers and a ruler, and she was calling out the measurements to a scribe.
This is a Caledonia xanthochyla, which is the yellow-lipped spider orchid, and it's one of the rarest plants that we have. There are only 3 that we have here in the Loddon Mallee region in existence. 51. They only have a single leaf, which is quite small too, and they have this delicate little underground tuber part that stores all of the nutrients for the plant. It's like a little miniature potato. Every year the plant goes dormant at different times of the year, and while it's in its dormancy, the orchid is replenishing all of its nutrients in its tuber. The orchid actually requires the assistance of a particular species of fungi in the soil. Now, this is a microscopic fungi. You can't really see it with the naked eye. And this fungi inoculates the seed when the seed hits the ground. If the seed lands somewhere where the fungi isn't present to, then the seed doesn't germinate and it's actually wasted. And it won't last for very long because it doesn't have an endosperm, so it doesn't store any nutrients, and so it will be lost. 4.5. Then if you're fortunate enough to have the plant germinated in the wild, it needs to make it through its first couple of years of life so that it can produce a nice, good, strong tuber. And then after that, it's on its way. And it might take a few years before the plant's actually big enough to flower. When it does flower, then there's this amazing relationship that takes place with its pollinating species. Okay, Margie, so we're finished in this pot.
Yes.
Okay, so this pot number 16 and I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 tiny babies going back in.
While the leader of the project, Julie Whitfield, concentrates on the task at hand, I wander over to the edge of the enclosure, which has been especially made to keep wallabies and rabbits away from the delicate orchids that will be planted within.
Right, there's the first 5. Might have a go, Wendy.
I squat near the fence and watch the secretary of the Friends of Kiura State Park, Wendy Murphy, poke a bamboo skewer into the ground to make a long, thin hole into which the orchid tuber will fit perfectly. She's brought her young daughter along too, and together they plant number 7.
You want to try?
Okay. Sort of, it sort of looks like wobbling a bit of wet spaghetti down into a tiny hole.
Yeah, it is pretty difficult. Get the bottom of the hole wide enough for the actual tuber is the hardest part.
I'm not sure, Jim. But mostly not just doing
the soil. We might let someone else do some planning because it's going to take a while with us. What is it actually like to put a plant that's so rare into the ground?
Well, it's pretty special. Considering there's only 2 and we've just planted, well, we've got 7 in there now. It's it feels good that you're actually reintroducing something back that has become so rare and endangered.
Your hands look remarkably calm.
Yeah, well, they weren't when you're doing that, I can tell you. You just don't want to spoil it. You want to make sure you get deep enough and you want to make sure that you're not hurting the tuber. It's, it's like holding a newborn baby, really.
Back over there.
You planted number 7, didn't you? Yeah. You can't see, you planted that one there. Number 7.
Not being able to see the orchids is normal. The yellow-lipped spider orchid has 1 leaf only, and they're only about 4 centimetres long at the moment.
We've got the cage with the 10 newly planted Caledonia xanthochyla, which is pretty exciting.
Russell Stanley is a member of the Australian Native Orchid Society, and we get down on our hands and knees next to the cage to examine in detail this tiny little ecosystem that the newly planted orchids now call home.
We've got various types of moss, coral lichen, chocolate lilies, as well as some of the scented sundews, the little drosseras, which catch insects for their survival. So I think Australia has got actually the biggest selection of carnivorous plants in the world.
So these ones that we've got down here, that have little red spiky hairs on them, how do they function in terms of how they eventually consume an insect?
Each of those little hairs has got a tiny little sticky droplet on them, and any small insect that comes along gets stuck by the droplets. You can think of them as little flypapers. And with many of the drosseras, then the leaf will actually curl a little bit and causing even more little droplets to come in contact with the insect. The insect then slowly dissolves and its nutrients are put into the leaf and into the ground. And the drosera is able to then absorb the nutrients from the ground via its root system. It's simply replacing the fact that there's very little nutrients in ground like this. And so it has to go and find fertiliser for itself to grow.
They seem to be all over this area, which is a dry. It is dry at the moment, but you know, sort of sparse woodland. And when you actually start looking, there's all manner of tiny plants, isn't there?
Yes, these particular sundew droseras, which we're looking at, are very similar to the orchids in the way that they survived the dry, in that they have a little tuber under the ground. And so they actually sprout from the tuber and grow during the wetter, cooler times, and then they'll shrivel up and retreat into the tuber again, draw all their nutrients back down into the tuber over summer. So that's just a survival mechanism which lots of plants have in this sort of environment.
You know what's startling about this is I watched 10 orchids get planted into that area and a cage get put over it, and even though I know they're in there and they're even marked, they're actually almost impossible to pick, aren't they? They're absolutely, completely blended in.
Yes, that's right. It needs a really experienced eye to be able to pick them, particularly when they're in the wild. We actually know that they're here and we have trouble actually finding them, but when you're actually walking through the bush and you've only got the leaf to look for, it's certainly a challenging proposition.
Well, if we come back in a while, we may see some flowering orchids here.
Yes, I'm hopeful. I think it's wonderful that a program like this actually occurs and, you know, is actually still funded by governments which seem to be more and more concerned about their spending habits. But it's just wonderful to have the prospect that these incredibly rare plants might actually survive for more generations to see. For me, handling them has been completely nerve-wracking because I'm very, very respectful of the amount of work which has gone into actually getting these plants to the stage where they are today. And one careless action could result in complete ruin of all of that effort. So, yes, it's a very stressful day, but a very rewarding day.
On RN, you're listening to Off Track. I'm Anne Jones, and today we're in Box Ironbark Forest in central Victoria, planting some of Australia's rarest plants, yellow-lipped spider orchids. These tiny orchids with one leaf only are just one part of an intricate web of biodiversity. Julie Whitfield explains as she's measuring orchid tubers.
All of our orchids are specific in terms of what will actually pollinate the plant. So with orchids, and in particular the caledonias that this project is looking at, they are actually pollinated by something called a thinned wasp. And it is so specific that even within the same genus, there are specific species that are responsible for pollinating specific species of caledonia. The orchids have co-evolved, and now they give off a pheromone which mimics that of the female wasp. The male wasp will fly in thinking that the flower is a female wasp, will try to mate with it, and in turn it will get frustrated and then move on to the next flower, which will in turn pollinate plant.
So in these particular ones, the ones you're holding in your hand, are in fact sexually deceptive orchids?
They most definitely are, yes. It's a process known as pseudocopulation. So the wasp is tricked into thinking that the flower is a female wasp. So not only is the flower itself giving off a pheromone, there is a labellum which is supposed to, I wouldn't exactly know because I'm not a wasp, but it's actually supposed to feel like a female wasp as well. So it's the right shape and it smells the same. So when the male flies in and tries to attach itself to the labellum and pick it up and fly away with it, it's tricked into cross-pollinating these plants. And we have four on the leaf width. The story behind the wasp itself is pretty amazing. The female wasp is a tiny little ant of a thing. She's very, very small and she can't fly. So she has no wings, but she feeds on the flowers in the canopies of the trees and on other shrubs and nectar-producing flowers. So she climbs herself to the top of a grass or a shrub or something along those lines and will actually give off the pheromone that will attract the male wasp in, 42, attract the male wasp in to collect her up and mate with her. And so what he does is while he's mating with her in flight, he will take her out for dinner, in a sense, and will take her up to the canopy to feed on the eucalypt flowers or the hakea flowers or whatever is around. And then once he's finished mating with her, he puts her back down on the ground so she can go about her business. And this is something that the clever little orchids have tapped into. Different species of orchids will give off a different pheromone that will attract that insect into coming in, thinking that it's mating with a female, and then in turn getting pollinated. And then the story goes even deeper than that, and the wasp for these Caledonias is actually a parasitic wasp. So it also parasitizes scarab beetle larvae. So you've got these relationships that are taking place, which I guess, you know, just signify how important it is to maintain our ecosystems as a whole. If we lose the scarab beetle and its larvae in the ecosystem, then we will have no pollinators. If we lose our pollinators, the plants won't be cross-pollinated and we get genetic bottlenecking, and over time the populations will die out. So it is a perfect example, 21, of how everything in the ecosystem works together. 1.5.
So, what was your name?
Marge, mate.
Hi, Marge. Yeah. How would you describe the leaf?
Oh, long, thin and furry with a maroon base.
Why are you involved with this project?
Well, I'm a member of the Friends of Kiura, and this is an area that grows a lot of orchids. You know, naturally common orchids, but dozens and dozens of them. It's one of our best wildflower areas in the park.
If you know how to look, there are little orchids all over the place here. And in fact, we put our bags down right next to a patch of them that I didn't even know until Marge pointed them out to me.
Here's the small Pterostylus nana, one of the most common orchids probably in the state. They group together and look at the extent of them. They're about 3 metres wide, 3 metres round.
What sort of flower do they have?
They're green. Yeah. They're about 2 centimetres high with two antennae and a little... This is the trouble. I could draw you one.
But that's part of the beauty, isn't it? That yes. These amazingly intricate flowers.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. And they'll only grow about 5 or 6 centimetres high, but there'll be a mass of them. The choughs get in and dig them up to eat them.
Wow. So, I mean, they're a beautiful bird, a chough, like a slim, small crow, but a very sociable bird, and they'd probably go through a patch of this in no time, I reckon, wouldn't they?
They virtually plough it up. Yes.
I suppose they'd be, it's very tasty and high in energy to eat the little bulbs on the bottom.
Yeah, they would be, yes.
Oh, there you go. So there are natural predators of the orchids.
Oh, definitely.
Marge draws me a picture of the Pterostylus nana flower, a green hood, which has a green flower, obviously, with two antenna spikes on it that stick right up as if you were putting your fingers to the side of your head like bullhorns. So why is it that the green hood goes so well in this environment? There's plentiful numbers around, whereas the yellow-lipped spider orchid that's being planted out today is in dire straits. Julie Whitfield.
I think for this particular species, we have a few factors that come into play. 6, I think climate change would be one. This area is quite dry. Development and agricultural practices have meant that a lot of the land is being used for other things and it's no longer forested area. So this species needs to be in good quality habitat, as with the majority of our Caledonias or our spider orchids.
Jeff Neville is one of the volunteers planting orchids today, but he used to work for the department running some of the orchid conservation programs, and he spent many weeks over the years since 2003 looking at the ground in this area, basically looking for traces of the yellow-lipped spider orchid. There's an enclosure not too far away that is keeping out the wallabies and rabbits, so there's an area that's quite dense vegetation, actually. So are there orchids over there?
There is one. There's actually two of these yellow-lipped spider orchids there now that we know of. But for probably 7 or 8 years, all the time I was going there looking, we could only find one. And we searched that enclosure, and it's not very big. You've seen it. It's only about 30 metres by 20 metres. And myself and a group of people searched that enclosure every year for more of those orchids, and we didn't find a single one. And then one year, an orchid enthusiast who came from out of the area and had been given directions to the site, and he went in there and he was just wandering around, and he found another one of these yellow-lipped spider orchids just sitting there flowering. And well, we were overjoyed, because having two meant we could cross-pollinate them and get good seed with good viability.
But it does really indicate about the difficulty of finding these tiny plants in the broad landscape that you could indeed. You probably went over that spot tens of times without seeing it yourself.
Oh, we probably did, and it may have been there just as a leaf some years and we wouldn't have spotted it amongst all the other leaves. And for some of those years it was probably dormant and no one knew it was there.
You worked for years in this area, and you're here today in a volunteer capacity, which indicates to me that there is something about orchids that keeps you coming back. So what's going on? Why is it? You're not getting paid for this now.
No, I'm not, but look, I waited for years for this day, and I hoped it would happen 5 or 6 years ago. And this fence here that I put up in 2010 was in preparation for planting these orchids into, and they just didn't materialise. The propagation didn't work, and the plants weren't ready.
The orchid is so delicately interlaced with the other organisms in its environment that it proved to be a huge challenge to recreate the ideal propagation conditions in a lab setting. Julie Whitfield.
Leaf length is 30. In order to grow the plants, we actually first need to grow up the fungus. I collect up the fungus from the wild and I deliver the fungus to Nushka Ryder, the ecologist that is responsible for growing our plants at the RBG in Cranbourne. We usually meet halfway, we swap the fungus over, and then she takes the fungus back into the lab where she has to actually extract the little palatons from the fungus under a microscope, and then she actually grows that fungus up on agar plates. Once the fungus is growing, then after I've collected the seed the following year from the wild and delivered that to Nushka as well, then she can actually grow up the fungus, and then she sprinkles the seed all over the fungus that's growing on agar plates. And if we're lucky, that seed will be inoculated with the fungus and it will germinate. Okay, and our tuber is a fatty one. He's putting in his replacement tuber right now. 7.5. So once the seed has germinated, you will have an agar plate and it will have all these fluffy little protocorms with little tiny leaf shoots on them, and that's obviously what we want to see. But the process from the fungal collection to the little tiny protocorms with little green leaves on agar plates is only the first step. There's still so much more we have to get through. So they then go from agar plate, they get pricked out and put into flasks with a different potting mix, I guess you would call it, and they stay in some climate-controlled conditions for a few weeks. And then from there, they're actually pricked out and they're put into pots. Then from the pots, they go into the nursery at the RBG, and they get watered and loved and treated with all the respect that they need, and then they go dormant. After the plants have gone dormant, or gone to sleep over the summer period, we actually have to hope that they re-emerge the following year. Around April, May, sometimes a little bit later, June, they'll start to put up leaves in the nursery, and then we can have a bit of an understanding as to how many plants we're actually going to have to plant back out into the wild. For some of the species that we've been working on this year through this project, we have actually been trying to do that for about 15 years. And so when I get that first phone call from Nushka to say, guess what? You know, we've got
we've got 5 Audacii have come up, or we've got 5 of this. And then this year I got a phone call from Nushka, and I'm sitting in my office. She goes, you're not going to believe this. She said, are you sitting down? And I'm thinking, oh no, here we go. Not again. Not again. But she says, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And she keeps going on. Then she says to me, you've got about 30 pots. And then she started counting the individuals, and we did a bit of a tally. And she goes, you've got about 460 xanthochilas this year. And that was incredibly exciting because we'd been trying to grow it for quite some time. And so today we're actually putting 200 of those back out into the wild.
There's a lot riding on these orchids that are being planted out today, which are being measured, numbered, noted, and then taken into the fenced enclosure and planted. Jeff Neville spins a tent peg in the ground to make the ideal spot for orchid number 76. So over a decade of work and waiting, what's it like today to actually be putting the skewer in the ground and making these holes?
Well, it's pretty awesome, actually. It really is. It's just like, wow, I never thought I'd see this after, you know, so many years. That's just great.
Will you be able to let them go?
Oh, I think so. I like the fact that because I don't live very far away, I can come back in a year or two and see them flowering. That's probably what I will do. Drive over one September and there they'll all be, flowering away. Yeah, I actually feel pretty lucky to be involved in this still, because I've waited so long to see these go in. But it's something very few people will ever get to do or to see, really. Yeah, so we're pretty lucky, aren't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Grow well, little orchids.
From 3 to 103 yellow-lipped spider orchids in one day, and long may they live. Photos are, of course, over at the website abc.net.au/rn/offtrack. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast there or on iTunes. You can listen to a stream. You can access the whole archive of natural history programs there as well. I'm Anne Jones, and this is Off Track on RN. And I'll see you here at the same time next week. That's when I'll take you somewhere else.
We won't have some of these species by the time I have grandchildren. We need to make sure that these species are still around when my children have their children. It needs to be understood that within an ecosystem there is nothing that is insignificant. There is nothing that is more important or less important than the next thing. These things all work together, and there are relationships happening out there that we don't even know about. We couldn't possibly understand.